Hello everybody and welcome to this video, which is kindly sponsored by Squarespace.
So today we're doing something just a little bit different. We're going to start a new page in the unlisted section, just blank page. And some of you may be aware that there are some rather large, rather nice maps of the Venice Arsenal in Venice. So we're going to put one of those up at an extremely high resolution. So you can see here we've got a blank page. I'm going to add an image. And it's on a grid system. I'm just going to drag that out because I want it to be a nice big image at first. Now I've preloaded a still relatively high resolution, but nowhere near as close as it could be, copy of the picture that I took already. And then I just drag it up so it fills as much as I want. Now I'm going to add a text box, drag that down underneath. I'm going to just type in what it is. And then I'm going to link it because I've linked the full scale over 60 megapixel, I think it is in fact 100 megapixel image in there. And you'll also have segments, about 9 to 12 segments, so you can put it together into an even larger, you know, almost gigapixel image if you want. Go back to the images page, incorporate that as a new entry, URL link it to the unlisted page, and it's all done.
So if after all these little mini tutorials I've been doing, you think you could build a website for maybe ideally naval history purposes, but you never know, you might want to do it for some other reason, then head over to squarespace.com/Drakenfell. You can get a free trial, and once you're ready, that little link will give you 10% off your first website or domain. So thanks once again to Squarespace for sponsoring the video, and on with the main show.
Well, after last month looking at the immediate pre-World War II and World War II era Swedish destroyers, a fair number of people in the comments were asking when I was going to cover the post-World War II Swedish destroyers that were still gun-based, so Halland class, for example. Well, those will come in five-minute guide terms at some point in the future. However, one of those post-war designs still survives. That is, of course, the Smaland, which can be found at the Meritaman Museum in Gothenburg, or apparently in Swedish, Göteborg? I think. Maybe one day I'll get that right, I'm sure. In any case, let me know in the comments below, Swedish people. In any case, she's there, and last year, the Shipshape Tour was privileged to be able to actually go aboard her. So, in the traditional manner, I'm going to have a look around the upper decks of the Smaland for you, so you can see what's there, and of course tempt you to perhaps going to visit there yourself to see the rest of what's on show within the ship. So, with all that said, let's get straight aboard the Smaland.
Right, so welcome aboard His Swedish Majesty's ship Smaland, and apologies to all people out there who speak Swiss, because I'm probably going to horribly butcher all the names subsequently, but this is also known as the Bofors Sails Brochure Gone to Sea. So we're going to start here with not the forwardmost armament, but the foremost of the gun armament. So this is a pair of 120mm rapid-fire Bofors guns. Depending on which source you're looking at, they either fire around every 1.2, 1.3 or 1.23 seconds per round. So you're talking about between 40 and 50 rounds per minute coming out of each gun. So, you know, being conservative, you'd be looking at 80 to 90 rounds per minute per turret, and there is another turret just the same as this aft. Now, Smaland is a fairly large destroyer for her time. She displaces between 2,500 and 3,000 tons, depending on whether she's lightly loaded or coming close to fully loaded. And this is typical-ish for her time period. Now, the reason I say for her time period is that when she is designed, which is in the immediate post-World War II period, Sweden is in a somewhat unique position compared to the other navies that still can actually build destroyers at this point. So, you know, the Americans, the British, the French to a certain degree, the Russians, etc., because all those other nations have been involved in World War II, so there's been a little bit of a pause, if you like, in their destroyer design. The Americans have just been hitting Control-C, Control-V for the Fletchers, and the British have gone through a whole series of wartime emergency flotilla ships. towards the end of the war, you have seen things like the Sumners and the Gearings and the Darings and the Battles, which are the next generation of destroyer design. But there has been that kind of pause. Whereas for the Swedes, of course, who have remained neutral throughout the entire conflict, they haven't had to worry about stopping everything, dropping everything, and building a ton of whatever they happen to have at the time. So they've actually been iterating in their destroyer designs throughout the early 1940s. And the destroyer design that we see here, which they build two of, actually reflects this considered design approach. So she's a little bit bigger than the destroyers that are typically in the remaining fleets of the period, because, as I said, you know, you're talking about Fletchers and wartime emergency flotilla stuff. So she's competitive with or slightly larger than the very latest designs of the other navies. And she reflects a lot of the lessons of World War II, but reflects them in a way that shows they've been able to consider their options before they actually go ahead and implement it. So these guns, there are only four as compared to the six guns you might find on most of the other immediate post-war destroyers. But as we mentioned, they're very, very rapid firing. And as we will see, there is another type of gun mounted just after this one, which takes the place of what on some of the early sketch designs was a third twin mount. And you'll see what I mean about considering their design choices for that. Now, before we move on from the 120mm guns, there's a few other things to take note of. Much like USS Turner Joy, you have sighting hoods up top. You've got your manual sighting areas. You can obviously use these, but ideally you'd be using your radar-directed fire control systems from the center of the ship. You can see from where all this tarp is that the guns can actually depress quite low, but they can also elevate incredibly high. So this is a full dual-purpose battery. And, of course, they're autoloaders. And being autoloaders, they also have two ammunition feeds for each gun. So one of them will be anti-surface rounds, the other one will be an anti-aircraft round. And that means that you can switch between the two very quickly and easily. So if, let's say, you're under attack, bearing in mind this is Sweden, so that, let's say the Baltic, perhaps you're being attacked by Soviet destroyers, you'll be sending lots and lots of anti-surface rounds at them. But then let's say the Soviet destroyers break off, and it turns out the reason they've broken off, if they sent a bunch of IL-28s in to try and bomb or torpedo you, well, the guns don't have to change anything apart from their aim, and they can immediately open up with anti-aircraft shells. And once the aircraft have been shot down or run away, and the Soviet destroyers are coming back in, well, you can switch back to anti-surface rounds nice and quickly. But they're also being very sneaky, because, of course, the Baltic has lots of islands, sometimes ice, and half the year it's in almost virtual darkness. Now, of course, you can use the radar, and radar has lots of advantages, but by the post-war period, as opposed to using radar some of the time in World War II, in the post-war period, almost anything worth its salt also has a radar warning receiver system of some kind. So you can use radar to see where the enemy is, but the enemy can also see where your radar is coming from and work out that either you're out there generally, or if they've got some of the more advanced systems, where precisely you are. So you might not actually want to use your radar all the time at night. Or perhaps if you're in a flotilla, one of your ships might want to use its radar and the others don't. But then if you want to open fire, well, you need some way of aiming at the enemy. If you're not using your radar, you need to see them visually. Well, how do you do that in the middle of a Baltic winter? Well, that's where these racks come in. So there are three racks on each side of this turret, and there's obviously three on the aft turret as well. And each of these racks contains illumination rockets, a more advanced version of star shell. And of course, being mounted on the turret, that means if you know roughly where the enemy is, you aim the turret, you're automatically aiming the illumination rockets. And then when it's time to open fire, you can launch your illumination rockets, light up the enemy, use your optical range-finding systems to lock on and open fire. And theoretically, because you've been under total emissions control, your enemy doesn't know that you're there. Or if they know that one ship is out there with radar, they don't know that the other two, three, four, five ships are also out there. So it should be a surprise attack. Now, of course, at that point, you can open up with your own radar and get a full lock-on, but you might not want to, because yes, you have just opened fire with a sneak attack, and hopefully you're plastering the enemy in high explosive, But you don't know if the enemy was trying to do that, and maybe they have other ships out there which are trying to do the same thing to you. So you can actually prosecute the entire attack using optical rangefinders and these illumination rockets, because as soon as the gunfire stops and the illumination rockets burn out, you've gone back to being purely stealthy, and the enemy still doesn't really have much of an idea where you are, because if they're trying to use their own optical systems to find where you are, the fact there's a massive burning magnesium flare over near one of their ships, and hopefully that ship is also on fire, is going to somewhat ruin their night vision. So that's our 120mm forward main turret. You can also see we've got some chocks for locking the guns in place. But we're going to take a quick spin around and look at the foremost weapon system on the ship as well. So we're here right up at the bow, along with the foremost weapon system. So this is actually two batteries of four launchers. You can only see one because the other one is behind this one. Now these are really, really big, 14 and a bit inch anti-submarine rocket mortars. Now these have a number of advantages over some of the earlier systems. So you will have seen on a number of World War II period ships, the Hedgehog system. The Hedgehog and its successors, Limbo and Squid, have an advantage over depth charges that you can fire them forward. So you can approach a submarine, keep a lock on with your sonar, and fire your charges and hopefully get hits. Hedgehog has small warheads, so you need to get a direct hit. Limbo and Squid fire full-size depth charges, so you don't need to get a direct hit because the explosion is big enough that it might still harm the submarine. These are another step ahead still. For one thing, unlike the triple launch you might get off of Limbo or Squid, obviously here you have four, and then you've got another four behind, so you've got eight, so you've got a lot more rounds. Additionally, as you can probably see, this is on its own turntable, so this is fully rotatable, fully elevatable. So you've got, well, I wouldn't necessarily want to fire it directly aft over the superstructure, but in theory you've got 360 firing. And the next element is, this is one of the rounds. So as you can see, it's nice and slim, it's got guidance fins, so this is going to go quite a distance. Being rocket powered helps with that as well. And being quite slim and sleek, it's also going to sink pretty quickly. So this is going to get onto your target very fast, and it carries several hundred kilos of explosive. So when it goes off, the submarine's going to feel it, and even if it doesn't get right up close, then the blast wave is probably still going to do a fair bit of damage. And as I say, Smarland here, we've got four launchers on this battery, and then the other battery directly behind it. So we've got a total of eight up front, which gives her quite a potent anti-submarine punch on top of anything she might be mounting further aft. The other thing which is actually quite of note compared to a lot of post-war destroyers and even World War II era destroyers is that because she's not a flush decker like, say, Turner Joy is, she doesn't actually have much, if anything, of a bow slope. You remember from the tour of Turner Joy, she has a really severe sharp bow slope because she's flush decked. Smarland uses the older style of design where you have a broken deck or a raised forecastle, or you know, whatever other design choice you want to call it. So essentially her forecastle is nice and level, and then around the level of her bridge it steps down one deck to continue further aft. So that means she's still got the high freeboard forward, which you need, but it also means that this deck is completely flat and level as far as most things are concerned. And that's quite important because it means that you can have multiple weapon systems up front like this without having to go into very complicated angled mountings. And for a ship that's really packing in the weapons, she needs every inch of deck space she can get. So here is the second part of the ship's gun-based offensive and defensive systems. This is a twin Bofors, again, 57mm installation. So this is a compromise. As I said, on some of the early designs, there would have been another twin 120mm here, but they decided to go with this 57mm because it's faster firing and faster to rotate than the 120 for anti-aircraft use. Again, you can see from that deep cut in the turret that it can elevate and depress quite a lot. And compared to the 40mm, which we'll see in a little bit, it could actually fire considerably further. Depending on whether you go by absolute or effective range, it has something between 1.5 to 2 times the range of a Bofors 40mm, even an L70, and it can obviously hit a lot harder with a 57mm round as well. So this is, technically speaking, a dedicated anti-aircraft weapon, but realistically, if you absolutely wanted to, you, as with the 40mm, you could hose down a surface target at closer ranges with 57mm rounds as well, which I'm pretty sure they wouldn't appreciate. So this really shows how much thought had gone into how to defend this ship by the late 1940s and early 1950s, where the air threat is now fully appreciated. Yes, you could have had 3 dual-purpose twin 120mm mounts, which would have given you a lot more protection against surface ships, 50% more firepower, but in the end, it was judged that actually, for both weight and defensive purposes, this twin 57mm system, a kind of intermediate between the 120 and the 40s, was actually a better bet, and this would defend the ship against the far more prevalent air threat, whilst the 120s would still do a relatively decent job defending you against the ground or surface threat. Because, of course, this being the Baltic, the ship could be expected to perform shore bombardment as well if it was called for. Right, so we've come up a deck level on the superstructure forward, and this is a Bofors 40mm, but as you've probably never seen it before, because, of course, we're all used to single, twin, and quad Bofors mounts in optionally powered World War II type mounts. This is a single Bofors 40mm mount, but as you can see, it's in a fully enclosed power-operated mount. And this ship actually has 6 of these. We've got one either side of the bridge here, got one either side of the aftmost funnel, and then another pair further aft still. So this is part of her dedicated anti-aircraft battery, whereas the 120mm we saw forward are dual-purpose. And this is kind of the next level of lethality for the Bofors 40mm, because if those of you who watched the channel quite a lot will remember, I pointed out by the end of the Second World War, the Oerlikon 20mm was actually almost being phased out because it was too short range for modern threats. The Bofors 40mm was itself under threat. While ships like Vanguard would commission with quite a lot of them, it was now kind of the minimum price of entry if you wanted serious anti-aircraft defense. And 3-inch autoloaders, for example, were taking over that role quite a lot. However, what the Swedes found, because obviously they have Bofors, so they've got the full range from the catalog, is that with the 40mm, you could actually, by making it fully automated, not massively increase its overall effective range, but massively increase its capability. And of course, with the weight of the mount, the weight of the power controls, the weight of the radar, etc., that's what means you've only got a single gun per mount instead of a twin mount or something like that. But since you have 6 of these mounts, you've got 3 40mm barrels per side, which for a destroyer, if you look at World War II destroyers, you might think that's not quite as too many, but bear in mind these are going to be much, much more accurate. So in terms of effective rounds on target, the 3 single mounts per side are actually going to be more effective than 10, 12 or 14 hand-aimed or basically radar-aimed Bofors 40mm from the Second World War. And so this is the smallest type of gun that you'll find on Smaaland used for short-range anti-aircraft defense. Right, so welcome to the bridge, or at least the open bridge, because of course, as we know, the open bridge is the superior choice for visibility. The Perspex screens there have seen better days, but you can generally get an idea of what kind of equipment we've got over here. So we've got a central position up here, one just slightly higher than everyone else. And then coming down, we have the one captain's chair, because this mount just here where I was, that would be for a signalling position. So there should be a signal lamp there, but there isn't. And this is actually quite useful because obviously signal lamps can double as searchlights, but being in a central position, it means they don't have to double up and have 2 big searchlights, because weight this high up on a ship this size is at a premium. They do have 2 smaller searchlights either side, but they're much, much smaller than what you would have up here. Then of course you have your compass, and you have all your other equipment. So a lot of this is in Swedish, so I can't read the labels necessarily, but this is a heading, a device. So you've got the compass, the 0360 compass, plus then a little dial in the middle which is showing you where the ship is relative to that. You have something called racket, which is measured in meters. It goes up to 3,000 meters.
I would guess that is the sub-rocket.
Okay, so I'm being told that's the submarine rocket launchers. In which case, if this is a submarine rocket launcher, then this would be not for the ship. This would be for the angle that the submarine rocket launcher is actually aimed at relative to the ship. So then the ship would be 0 to 180, and then this dial would be which direction it's pointing in, with a bunch of additional indicators. Which actually makes a lot of sense, because if those deflectors are in place, I can't quite see the full extent of the rocket launchers from here if I'm standing in a normal position. If I go over to here and gaze over, I can just about see, but my estimates of angle are going to be somewhat off. Then you've got your RPM going back and forward. You've got a good old voice tube, just in case you can't use radio for whatever reason. You can see here there's a radar screen. This is now definitely in the PPI era rather than the oscilloscope era. That's undercover. What you can't see from there but is behind here is another much bigger, probably somewhat more modern radar screen. That's a green screen, so much more familiar to people. And then over here will be the sonar operators area. Again, nice and sheltered because you don't want the sea to get into there. So in some ways, not a lot has changed from the Second World War, but in other ways, quite a lot has changed, because this is now a fully integrated open bridge system with all those electronic systems, detection systems, etc., that you would have previously had refitted into a Fletcher class or a Tribal class or something like that. This has all been intentionally laid out in the Smarland. And this is looking back from the same position on the bridge. And as you can see, we have a bunch of different sensor systems. We've got multiple radar systems here, navigation, air search, surface search, etc., go both on the bridge itself and going up on the radar mast. The radar mast is retractable for going under narrow bridges or reducing your profile. And you can also see there's a bunch of passive warning receivers up there in a little cluster just forward of the main spinny radar. So this ship is covered in a lot more sensors than you would typically find on either a World War II era destroyer or indeed a World War II refit, because of course all of this is again weight up top, which affects stability. So even the very largest of the Second World War's destroyers would have some issues having absolutely everything stuck on them without losing stuff further down. Whereas with Smarland, of course, most of this will have been planned from the get-go. Obviously, there are some more modern systems because she was in service for quite a while. But if we go just a little bit aft and drop the camera down, you can see one of the smaller signal lights. But you can also see back aft there, there's another much, much bigger radar mounted on the main mast. And then in here is the fire control station, because, of course, this is an unarmored destroyer. There's no point in having CIC for or fire control plotting, etc., further down in the ship. And then finally, up here on the bridge, we have this system. So you might recognize this as a relative of the one that's in a similar position on HMS Belfast. So this is a basic rangefinder and spotting system, and there's two of these, one on each side. So we found the ship's bell, which of course means it must be rung. And now I have no hearing left. Right, so before we go further aft, I'm just going to point out a couple of additional things. So here we have some spare 40mm barrels. Now, why would you need spare 40mm barrels? Well, obviously, if they wear out. Now, of course, whilst Smarland and her sister ship were capable of going fairly long distances around the world, they're primarily designed for the Baltic. So you might think, well, they can just come back and replace those gun barrels. So why do we have eight? Because there's four on this side, four on the other side. Well, part of the reason is that the 40mm Bofors, one of which you can just see behind me there, this is not the 40mm Bofors of the Second World War. The 40mm of the Second World War is the L60, so it's 60 calibers long. This 40mm is the L70, it's 70 calibers long, slightly higher rate of fire, slightly higher muzzle velocity, and of course the slightly higher muzzle velocity coupled with, you know, the fact they're in automatic guided turrets means that you might actually burn through the barrels a lot faster than you would with the 40 mils you might find on a battleship or a cruiser of World War II. The other thing, of course, is that, as we mentioned, they're using fewer barrels with higher accuracy on the Smarland, and that in turn means that whereas on a battleship, if you do happen to burn through a barrel or two, it doesn't matter too much because you've got another 60 or 70 to go. Here, if you've only got six and you burn through one, that's 1/6 of your entire 40mm battery down. So it's important to be able to swap out these things. The other thing that's quite notable just here as we progress aft are these spools. So these are almost certainly guidance cables for the torpedoes, which we're going to see in a minute, or at least for the torpedoes which were used on the ship later on in its service. Right, so we're now moving just slightly further aft to the forward of the ship's two torpedo launchers. Now, this again marks the ship out as slightly different compared to most, not all, if you're the Imperial Japanese Navy, but most World War II period destroyers. So originally, when the ship was launched, it had two quadruple torpedo sets. This forward one has four tubes at the moment, but according to the museum information, at the point that she left service, she actually had five launchers here, which is probably why there's the gap in the middle. But the reason for this will become apparent a little bit later on when we spin around and look at the aft launcher. But the reason this is a fairly unique setup is not necessarily that. You can see here we've got one of these torpedoes, but you'll notice this torpedo is sitting on a set of carts, which is sitting on a set of rails. And these rails, they run from just about where the replacement 40mm Bofors barrels are, run aft past the camera to where the triple launcher is, but there's a little set of points like a railway where they also run to here where this forward launcher is. And the reason for that, and possibly just about see the crane back there as well, is that this ship can actually carry spare torpedoes, is designed to carry spare torpedoes, and can reload them, which is what the carts are for. So you can carry torpedoes, or as we'll see later on in a little bit, missiles, down in that hatch. The crane will bring them back up and out if you need to reload. They go on the carts, and the carts will come down and they will feed straight into the tubes, either back there or here. So the other thing to note, of course, is that because these torpedo launchers are a deck higher than you might find on most destroyers, they use the older school gunpowder charges to get the torpedoes not just out over the edge of the deck, but out with enough velocity that they're still going in at something approaching a horizontal angle rather than just nosediving straight in. So torpedo launchers, but that's only half the story. Right, so here's the other half of the torpedo launch system. Now, as I mentioned before, originally this would also have been a quadruple set, but as you can see above me, there are now a pair of surface-to-surface anti-ship missiles stuck on top. So this was reduced to a triple launcher to save not the space, but to save the weight to allow this launcher system to be added on top of them. This makes Smarland and, of course, her sister ship somewhat unique in that they are the first destroyers to carry an operational dedicated anti-shipping missile system. Other destroyers did carry missiles before them, but those missiles were either surface-to-air missiles, which occasionally could have been used impromptu in a anti-surface role, or they were occasional somewhat unwise experiments with seeing if you could fling a cruise missile or cruise missile equivalent off of it, not something that was going to actively home on a ship. So these two are the first examples of dedicated anti-shipping missiles installed aboard a destroyer, and this obviously is fairly early on in the general concept of the anti-shipping missile, which is obviously a little bit past the Channel's time period. But as you can see, these missiles, as opposed to the modern things we're used to, which, well, okay, with stealth and stuff, they now resemble poor, low-polygon models, but the traditional anti-shipping missile generally resembles a cylinder with some fins and maybe a wing or two. These more resemble downscaled jet aircraft without cockpits, in common with a lot of other early anti-shipping missiles. But there they are, and obviously, because they're stuck on top of the torpedo launcher, they're fully trainable, and you can launch them off the sides, which is probably just as well, because immediately behind the camera, we have the second funnel, the aftmost funnel, and the second pair of 40mm anti-aircraft guns. So here's a little bit more detail on the missiles. Amusingly for English speakers, they're actually called Robot, which is more applicable than you might think, because of course they are automated. And as we were saying earlier, you've got your wings, you've got your booster rockets to get them off of the thing, off of the launch rail in the first place, then you've got your main engine back there, little tails. Apparently these are designed based off of target drones. So for those of you in perhaps the US, you might see something of a resemblance to the Ryan Firebee drone, but these are apparently based off of a French design. So no angry Firebee for you, I'm afraid. And then coming back down here, we've got the back end of the triple launcher. And whereas the hatch forward is for the torpedoes, here's your reloading hatch for the missiles. Now, you remember earlier I mentioned that while we're up here, we are a deck higher than you might normally find for a destroyer for this kind of armament. And that's because what we're walking on at the moment, this deck below us, this is a continuous superstructure. It goes from the bridge all the way aft. And that is because, again, reflecting the design decisions of the immediate post-war period, Smarland is fully pressurized internally. So she's designed for a nuclear, biological or chemical warfare environment, an NBC environment. And by having the entire superstructure effectively raised one level, that meant you could go fore to aft on the ship without interfering, obviously, with the internal bulkheads down when you're in action stations, without going outside, which allows you to fully pressurize the ship and protect the crew against those kinds of threats, which is quite important given the situation that she was expected to be operating in. So coming in here, so we've come back to the forward quad launcher. You can see this is the gap where the fifth torpedo launcher would be in her later state. And this is what a torpedo turntable looks like, if you happen to be interested. And then, of course, we have our second and third Bofors 40mm mounts. And this one has the internals visible. So just the one gun there with the feed at the top. And then ammunition can be obviously fed in here and the gun can be fired. And there's operational seating for the crew, because of course you do want to be able to take over if necessary. And you can probably just about see up there, there's an openable hatch if you have to aim the gun manually. And we've come right after, this is the aft end of that upper superstructure. So you can see we've got the other two 40 millimeters back here. This is just after the main mast. Now, of course, you've seen inside one of these things, you've got all the ready use ammunition clip holders here. And then as we come round here, you'll find ammunition, spare ammunition cases or lockers. And then right in the middle here, right at the very back, this is the hoist for new 40 millimeter ammunition. So whereas you would have had clipping rooms and a lot of manual passing on a World War II era ship, you can see just there at the bottom at the back, that's an electric motor. So that will be running a continuous hoist, continuous endless chain. So that will be a powered hoist bringing up 40 millimeter rounds, which will be extracted from here. And you'll see there's these two handles, and obviously they don't seem to make much sense next to each other. Well, that's fine, because that's just their storage position, because if the endless chain fails, then you can have a manual cranking system. So whoever gets that duty is really not going to be very happy. But you've also got a little voice tube up here so you can talk to the guys down in the magazine. And of course this is necessary because although you've got ammunition clip holders in the turrets, the 40 millimeter turrets, and you've got all of these spare clips here, with an L70 40 millimeter Bofors you're going to burn through a lot of ammo very quickly, so you might need more to come up. So this is the very, very back end, as I said, of the superstructure. And just over behind us here, we have the aft twin 120 millimeter. So we're now going to go one deck down and see what they've got on the aft deck weaponry wise. Incidentally, if you happen to come here to Marikman, there's a lot of other stuff. There's the Hugin P151, a patrol boat. There's another smaller boat just there. And there's a lot more stuff to see. not all of which you can get in frame here, but I probably will have some drone footage going, which you can see it as well. But there's a submarine. It's a very small submarine, not much larger than a German Type 7, but has a much, much bigger sail because it's a Cold War era sub. So let's go down one level. So we've come right aft, or almost right aft, and of course we have our aft 120mm with, again, the illumination rocket launchers. But this is another part of Smalland's systems of, well, offence, defence, depends how you want to define it. The thing you've got to remember, of course, is that although Smalland and Halland are large destroyers for the time period, compared to on average, as we've said before, the Swedish Navy cannot afford a huge number of ships generally. And so they have to be multi-purpose. You know, these ships are very good at anti-surface action with their torpedoes and later missiles and the 120mm guns. They've got the four 120mm, the two 57mm and the six 40mm for anti-aircraft defense. But on top of all of that, they also have, as we saw, the anti-submarine rocket launchers up front, but we also have mines. So these, here's mine rails. They extend right aft, and you can tell the ship was designed with this in mind because the hull at the stern actually cuts down on both sides to continue the rail, which we'll see in a minute. But these mine rails go almost all the way up to the forecastle rise. So there's a lot of mines you can fit on here. We see we've got a slightly smaller mine type here, and then we've got the slightly larger mines here. All of them have their weight and cable system to allow them to automatically set their depth, and all of these would allow you to lay very quickly a significant and dangerous minefield in the Baltic regions. And of course they're fairly easy to reload as well. If you don't use mines, you can of course put depth charges on the back as well, but depth charges are something of an old hat by this point, although still useful if you absolutely have to use them. And this emphasizes the multi-role nature of these vessels, because most navies obviously would use a dedicated mine-laying vessel and just have mine-laying as an incidental option on their destroyers, whereas the Smalland has this as an integrated part of her mission right from the very start, because then that means at the beginning of hostilities, or even as hostilities are growing before wars have officially broken out, she has a very active and useful role. And then once the shooting starts, well, in the calmer periods, she can still lay or maintain minefields. And in the slightly less calm periods, she doesn't have to carry mines. She can carry all sorts of things and continue on with her mission. Now, what we're going to do is come around here to show you two other features of the ship. So, more directly, this is what I'm talking about with the mine ramp heading down. So, specifically built into the ship. The other feature is quite obviously a post-construction addition. Believe it or not, this is a helipad for a very, very small, very brave helicopter pilot. And as you can see here, the panels actually fold out. So this can all be, to a certain extent, minimized and wrapped up. Spare supplies and everything for the helicopter can be stored underneath. But in extremis, if you want to, you can actually land a helicopter on the back of the ship, albeit that all the pictures seem to indicate this is a helicopter that has some fairly large, fairly bulky floats, because I really wouldn't want to try and land something with wheels or a skid on that, because that is not even half the size of a tennis court, let alone it's not even the particularly even the size of half a tennis court, maybe a third the size of a tennis court. So it would take a very brave pilot to make that landing, although, you know, they did. So that's the full range of Smalland's weapon systems above decks. So let's go and see what we can find below for a little while. So we're a couple of decks down, and you saw the two missiles up above, but don't worry, they have friends. This is the missile storage magazine. And as you can see, although part of it has been converted into a learning center, they have retained at least one missile down here, although by the looks of the cradle and the overall size of this room, you could store at least four missiles down here, because you've got this one just here, and then you've got this, which is obviously storage for at least one more missile here, and you can see the way the wings are folded up. Then you've got the magazine hoist system, which sends it up that big hatch we saw above, and then presumably if you mirror it on the other side, that's four missiles at least, so that's at least six missiles that the ship has. But if we come round to the hoist system, you'll see here is our missile hoist, and then going up, there is a missile again with wings folded, ready to go out of the hatch, which is just up there. So in theory, you could actually potentially even have up to seven missiles if you were prepared to keep one on the hoist. Although, unless you know that you're going into combat fairly quickly, I think that probably wouldn't be a viable long-term solution, but certainly something you could do in wartime if you wanted that extra shot. So one of the other things that's quite interesting about this ship is what you can see of the hull material as we're walking. Now, some of it is sheet steel, as you can see here. The hull is obviously all structural steel, but this superstructure, which, as I mentioned, is put in so that you can go the whole length of the ship internally, because there are bulkheads in the way further down, you'll notice a lot of this is corrugated galvanized steel that's then been painted over. And the reason for this was, again, weight saving, because they thought about using aluminium, and they concluded that's far too much of a fire hazard. But if they used full thickness steel like you have here everywhere, then that would put the weight, especially the top weight, up into an unacceptable margin. And so what they decided to do instead was go with this corrugated material, which you won't see on many other ships, if any. And although obviously the corrugation means it has a slightly greater surface area, that's more than compensated for by the much thinner material that you can use for the similar strength. And so that reduces your top weight, which keeps the ship more stable, or in the case of Smarland, just allows you to put a lot more guns on it.
And that wraps up our Above Decks tour of Smarland. Thank you very, very much to the Meritaman Museum in Gothenburg in Sweden for, well, letting us come aboard, letting me obviously film and letting me take this drone footage, although there was a rather interesting ceiling to this drone footage, because if you went much above the altitude you can see here, you came in direct line of sight of a ship that apparently was not to be filmed further down in the harbour, and drones mysteriously stopped working. So we're quite lucky that the altitude happened to be just a little bit higher than Smaland's mast top. But in any case, if you happen to be in Gothenburg, either because you live there or you live nearby or you are travelling there, please do go and give the Maritiman Museum your support. You can see there the little sub coming into view. They are in the middle of ongoing conservation work. You can see as we pass down Smarland, you can see exactly where the conservation work had reached at the point that we were actually there. And the rust aft is similar to what was forward before they're able to clean it up. And work is, of course, ongoing. And although Smarland is their single largest exhibit, there are obviously all the other ships and the sub that also need maintenance. And it's not exactly bank-breakingly expensive to go aboard. Their entrance fees are very, very reasonable. And if you're interested, they also have a pretty decent gift shop and a pretty decent cafe restaurant. Now, I appreciate that of the Scandinavia trip, you've now got the Smarland and the Gothenburg, the East Indiaman replica, which is a little bit out of order because we were, of course, first in Norway before we got down to here. And in fact, we were also in Karlskoga before we got here as well. But those things will come with time. Also, shout out to the various wonderful Swedish and nearby subscribers who showed up to say hi as we were there. You may have caught glimpses of yourselves in the periphery of the camera shots. And for those of you who backed the trip and are wondering where your Scandi trip coins, etc. are, they should be with you in the next few months. And that pretty much wraps up our look at Bofors' greatest floating sails brochure, also known as the mighty destroyer Smarland. Thanks for watching, and hope to see you again in another video coming soon to a screen near you.